We're continuing our study of the future, and today's session is on future wars. In Matthew 24:3, the disciples had asked Jesus, you probably remember this verse, they asked him, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Remember that? We talked about what it meant by the end of the age. We kept looking at that phrase. This was the original question the disciples asked him. Now, in his answer, his response to their question, the first thing he mentioned was deception. He says, watch out that you're not deceived. He specifically said there would be many false Christs, right? Remember that? The second thing he mentioned was wars. And that's our topic for this evening. In Matthew 24:6, he said, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. You see the same things in Mark 13 and Luke 21. He said, you will hear of wars. The word war, there's from a Greek noun that means armed conflict against an enemy. So it means the same thing as our English word war means. You'll hear of wars and rumors of wars. The word rumor there is a Greek noun that means news or report or information about an event. See to it that you're not alarmed. The word alarm there is from a Greek verb that means to be filled with apprehension or alarm. It means to be unpleasantly surprised. Have there been many wars since 1900? Many and almost continuously, right? Have technology and scientific discoveries made wars more devastating since 1900? Definitely. During the period that's called the beginning of birth pains, world calamities will increase in frequency and severity, right? Birth pains, frequency and severity. So, should we expect the same for wars? Do you think we should expect them to be more frequent and more severe? I think so. In the book of Revelation, the first five chapters of the book include the revelation of Jesus, the letters to the churches, and the presentation in heaven of a scroll having seven seals. Remember that? You familiar with those passages, those chapters? Well, the seven seals are the first descriptions in the book of Revelation of end-time world events, the seven seals. And the first four seals present what we call the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Apocalypse is Revelation, that's the book in general. Look at Revelation 6, verses 1 and 2. I watched as the Lamb opened the first of the seven seals. Then I heard one of the four living creatures say in a voice like thunder, come. I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on conquest. So, what color was his horse? It was white. And what does the color white represent usually?
Purity.
Purity, yes. Righteousness, holiness, cleanliness, right? Well, look at the description of the rider there. It says he held a bow. Now, that word bow there is from a Greek noun that means a bow, as in bow and arrows, right? He held a bow. He received a crown. Now, the word crown there is from a Greek noun, stephanos, which means a crown or a woven garland. It means a prize or a symbol of successful activity. Now, here's a key point. This crown is a reward for victory or success. It says he was given a crown. You follow me? This is not the same kind of crown as spoken of as a diadem, which is the diadem crown worn by a king or a ruler. All right. Now, originally, I thought that's what it was, so I thought this represented government, but it doesn't. This represents reward for success or victories. And he was a conqueror bent on conquest. So, what does all this suggest about the nature and the intent of this writer?
He's been a warrior.
He's been a warrior. He's been victorious, yes. He's been rewarded for his victories, right? And what about that last phrase there? What does that describe about his intent? He rode out how? As a conqueror, right? And he's bent on conquest. In other words, he's going to be victorious again, right? Okay? Well, the color of his horse suggests an image of purity and righteousness, and his imagery indicates a warrior who is successful, he's been rewarded for his victorious achievements, and he's setting out to accomplish more. There is a religion today that meets all these criteria. It presents itself as pure and righteous. It has a God and a Messiah. It's very aggressive, even militant and combative. It's determined to conquer and has been victorious. And it's based on deception. For example, it presents itself as a religion of peace. Can anyone tell me what that religion is?
Islam.
You know, even Muslim clerics, looking at Revelation 6:2, identify that horse and the rider as Islam. They look at that chapter and say, yeah, that's Islam, that's us. So Revelation describes four horses with riders, each horse a different color. Then Zechariah 6 describes powerful horses pulling four chariots, and each set of horses is a different color. It's interesting, I think significant, that the first horse in both sets, the horses are white. And in Zechariah 6 says the white horses are charging toward the west. What region of the earth is Islam currently focusing on?
Israel, which is west of, yeah.
Well, not really.
Yeah.
They're focusing on which we call the west, right? Yeah. Which is west of Israel. Yeah. So I think Zechariah and Revelation are parallel with each other, describing the same process of events. Let me talk for a little bit about Islam, the nature of Islam. The ultimate goal of Islam is not to convert the world to Islam, but to establish Sharia law. In other words, their goal is world domination. They want the world dominated by Sharia law. And deception is a major element of Islam. In fact, Muslims are commanded in the Quran to conceal their beliefs and the doctrines of Islam. They misrepresent Islam intentionally so that we don't really know what it is. Deception is a key. It's a vital part of Islam. For example, jihad is not a perversion of Islam, as we're being told. Jihad is a mandate. So they misrepresent themselves. They say, no. Islam is just a religion of peace. You know, we're not here for war. Oh, yes, they are. The Quran says so, and it tells them to be deceptive, misrepresentative, to mislead people about their true intent. In fact, Islam, the Quran states that any Muslim who does not misrepresent Islam is an infidel. And
it also says it's perfectly fine to lie to someone if they're not Islamic.
Oh, exactly. Well, deception is a key part of it. It certainly is. Moving right along. Please. Yeah. Yeah. Muslims consider themselves the house of peace, and they consider everyone else the house of war. You see, their goal is to impose their definition of peace on the world. And their definition of peace is everybody under Sharia law. That's their definition of peace. So, if we all concede and agree to go under Sharia law, there's no need for battle, right? It's easy. That's their perspective. It was all our fault because we resisted. Muslims view treaties as a strategy for conquest. This is another key point here, okay? Muslims view treaties as a strategy for conquest, and that's based on some of Muhammad's first victories in combat. They use treaties as opportunities to gain advantage over their enemies. So they typically make treaties and then violate them when they are ready to conquer. Now, that may shed light on Daniel 9:27, which we talked about two sessions ago. Remember we talked about the Antichrist setting up a treaty for 7 years, and then after 3.5 years, he nullifies the treaty, basically. He sets up the abomination of the temple, and his people trample on Jerusalem. That's the way most Muslims work. That's the way Islam is structured. You make a treaty, which allows you to get things in order so that you are sure that you're going to conquer your enemy. In other words, the Antichrist is going to honor the treaty he has set up until he is ready to conquer his enemy. That's what it looks like. Now, in addition, according to Muslim doctrine, any land that was once under Muslim control must remain under Muslim control, even if the majority of the citizens there are not Muslims. If they occupy the land at any time, they claim it as theirs. During the time of the Ottoman Empire, that was from the 1500s to 1917, Muslims occupied Israel, including Jerusalem. And that is why Muslims today now refer to the land as being occupied by Israel. They consider it their land. And Israel's there, so Israel is the occupying force, and that's what they call them. They consider the land theirs because they once held it. They once occupied it. Therefore, we can expect biblical end-time prophecies to contain evidence of wars between the Muslim nations and Israel. Would you believe? Now, I could spend days, if not longer, talking about Islam's impact on the end times, but we're focusing this evening on future wars. Okay, so that's going to be our topic for this evening. Any questions or comments on material so far? Let's talk about wars against Israel. I see the likelihood of three major Middle East wars in the future. Two of those could happen during the beginning of the birth pains, like that is before the Great Distress. Okay, here we have the beginning of the birth pains, then we have the Great Distress. This is started by what here, the Great Distress? What begins that? The abomination of desolation set up in the temple, right, in Jerusalem. So, here's where we are right now. I believe we are in this beginning of birth pains. I think the signs have already begun. Great Distress starts with the abomination set up in the temple in Jerusalem. That lasts for how long? 3.5 years. Remember? 42 months, 1,260 days. It was a 12-month, 30-day calendar, 360 days a year. Followed by a cosmic disturbance. The sun turns black, the moon turns red, stars fall from the sky, blah, 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 cosmic disturbance. That lasts for possibly 30 days, as we talked about before, and then the day of the Lord. So here's the sequence. Now, I'm suggesting that these first two Middle East wars I'm going to talk about probably happen here, the beginning of birth pains. First of all, there's the Psalm 83 war, which involves Israel's immediate Muslim neighbors, and that could happen any time. In fact, I see it developing now. Okay? And then there's the Ezekiel 38 Magog invasion. That involves Israel's more distant Muslim neighbors and happens before the Great Distress here, before the abomination set up in the temple. I believe it likely will happen during the beginning of birth pains preceding the Middle East Treaty. Remember, the seven-year treaty is set up here in the beginning of the birth pains. So halfway through it, he sets up the abomination, which begins the Great Distress, and then the Great Distress will last for another 3.5 years. So I believe that both the Ezekiel, Psalm 83 and the Ezekiel 38 wars will happen before that moment right there at the beginning of the distress or tribulation. During the Great Distress, after the peace treaty is enforced, Jerusalem will be trampled by the occupying force. Now, this might not be considered a war because Israel will be totally vulnerable at that point because they were unable to defend themselves due to the so-called treaty. They agree to the treaty, they lay down their arms, they withdraw their troops, they're not prepared for what's about to happen to them. So we have the Psalm 83 war, then the Ezekiel 38 war, then the trampling of Jerusalem, which is not really a war, it's an abuse by an occupying force, okay? They devastate the nation and the city. And then the other war in the end times is the war of what we call the Battle of Armageddon. And that involves nations worldwide during the Day of the Lord, down here. During the Day of the Lord, after the Lord returns to earth to rule. So let's look at the Psalm 83 war. I've given you Psalm 83, verses 1 through 8, on your worksheet. I'd like to read through that. This is a very interesting psalm. In fact, it seems mysterious unless we consider it in the context of the end times.
I don't mean to distract you, but you see the Six-Day War in here anywhere? Because that was surely a quickening of Israel. You don't see it anywhere?
It's not one of the three major end-time wars, no. Battles. No. It was a significant event in the history of Israel, certainly. It was part of Israel becoming who they needed to be before all these things could happen, yes. 1948, the Six-Day War in 67, the 1973 war, all those were very key in building Israel up so that they are where they are now, with their military might, their Mossad, you know, their intelligence agencies and so forth. Those were all, those battles were instrumental in making Israel who it is now. which prepares them for this stuff here. We need to keep moving. Yeah. Let's look at Psalm 83 here. It seems very mysterious unless we consider it in the context of the end times. Let me read it to you. O God, do not keep silent. Be not quiet, O God, be not still. See how your enemies are astir, how your foes rear their heads. With cunning, they conspire against your people. They plot against those you cherish. Come, they say, let us destroy them as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. With one mind, they plot together. They form an alliance against you. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab, the Hagrites, Gegal, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia and the people of Tyre. Even Assyria has joined them to lend strength to the descendants of Lot. Selah. What does Selah mean? It means to stop and consider, to rest and to ponder, as I understand it. Now look at verse 4. According to verse 4, what is their goal? To destroy Israel as a nation. Even erase the memory of them, right? Does that sound familiar? That's the current mantra, isn't it? Isn't that what they say behind our backs? Israel's enemies today threaten to wipe Israel from the face of the earth, to drive them into the sea, however you want to phrase it. It all means the same thing. We want to be done with them. We don't want to have any vestige of them left whatsoever. This is our land, the Muslims say. This is our land, and we will get it back. Now look at the details of verses 6, 7, and 8. Where he lists the people groups and the geographical areas. Do you think God gave us these details for a reason?
Sure.
Well, of course. Look at your Psalm 83 map that I gave you there. Psalm 83 map. The nations in Psalm 83 are all Muslim people or regions. They're not all Arab. They're all Muslim, but not all Arab. Israel's conflicts today are with Muslims. Those right there on your map are the nations that are listed in Psalm 83. Now let's consider the result of Psalm 83 war. Look at verses 13 to 17. This refers to the nations and people groups that are listed as enemies in the previous verses, okay? Here's what it says. Make them like tumbleweed, O my God, like chaff before the wind. As fire consumes the forest or a flame sets the mountains ablaze, so pursue them with your tempest and terrify them with your storm. Cover their faces with shame so that men will seek your name, O Lord. May they ever be ashamed and dismayed. May they perish in disgrace. This calls for the total defeat of the invading armies. Total defeat.
They're calling out for God to do it.
Yes. Israel is calling for God to take care of them, to defeat their enemies. Now, I want to draw your attention to Isaiah 11. Because considering the context in Isaiah 11, it looks like a parallel to Psalm 83. So let's look at it, verses 12 to 14. It says, He will raise a banner for the nations and gather the exiles of Israel. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from the four quarters of the earth. Ephraim's jealousy will vanish, and Judah's enemies will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, nor Judah hostile towards Ephraim. They will swoop down on the slopes of Philistia to the west. Together they will plunder the people to the east. They will lay hands on Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be subject to them. Now, according to verse 12, when will this happen? What does it say?
After the gathering of Israelites.
Yes, after the gathering of the exiles. He will assemble the scattered people of Judah from around the world, right? So this war happens after God has called the Jews back to Israel. That's happening now. Refers to Ephraim and Judah. Ephraim was the northern part of Israel, and Judah was the southern portion. This says there will no longer be any hostility between them. You might recall there was a lot of hostility during Jesus' time. In fact, if you were walking through northern Israel and people knew that you were heading for Jerusalem, they wouldn't have anything to do with you. Okay, they might even be antagonistic towards you because you're one of them. Okay, that was the animosity between those two groups of people. There was a reason for it, but that's not the point right here. But this says right here that there will be no more hostility between the northern and southern tribes. Now, notice that Isaiah 11 lists some, but not all, of the nations and peoples identified in Psalm 83. It says that Israel will swoop down on Philistia. That's Gaza. It says they will plunder the people to the east. That's possibly Syria and or Iraq. It says they will subject or control Edom and Moab and the Ammonites. That's Jordan and probably the West Bank. In other words, Israel will defeat all who invade her, but devastate only a few. I think they are less likely to devastate Jordan, for example, because Jordan has been pretty a good neighbor with them, even though they have serious disagreements. And you might notice here it just says they will subject or control Edom and Moab and the Ammonites. So here's some possible conclusions. There likely will be a Middle East war in Israel which destroys or neutralizes Egypt, Jordan, Palestinians, that's Gaza and the West Bank, Lebanon, and Assyria, which is probably the northern portions of Israel or Iraq. No, I mean the northern portions of Syria or Iraq. After eliminating the threat from her immediate neighbors, again, these are all her immediate neighbors, and after eliminating the threat from her immediate neighbors, Israel will be at peace and free to remove the current security barriers, becoming a land of unwalled villages, as she's described in Ezekiel 38:11. She has defeated, totally neutralized, all of her immediate Muslim neighbors. They're no longer a threat to her, so she can take down the barriers that currently are trying to protect her from them. You see? Now, this war with the local Muslim nations will absolutely inflame world opinion against Israel. Now, they're already anti-Semitic, and they're already demanding the two-state solution. But this war, I believe the Psalm 83 war, will provide the motivation for the Ezekiel 38 invasion of Israel. Now, this is speculation, obviously. Definitely speculation, but it presents an intriguing explanation for Israel's immediate neighbors not being listed in Ezekiel 38. None of the ones listed in Psalm 83 are listed in Ezekiel 38. And this is a possible explanation, because the group in Psalm 83 are devastated. They're no longer a threat. They can't even retaliate, even if they join with other forces. I mean, they can't attack Israel, even if they join with other forces. They've been totally neutralized. So I think this provides a pretty good explanation for why those nearest neighbors to Israel are not included in the massive invasion in Ezekiel 38. Speculation, but I think it's a good explanation. Any questions or comments, what we covered so far? Because they fought back, yes. Yeah, these nations will attack Israel. That's clear. They attack Israel. Israel is not an aggressor nation. And they have declared publicly that they will not strike first. But they will defend themselves and they will retaliate against strikes. So the passage we looked at here, both Psalm 83 and Isaiah 11, both state that the neighboring nations attack Israel. And Israel, in self-defense, destroys their armies. Any other questions or comments about what we covered so far?
So all the Arabs that are hanging around the borders of Israel are all Muslims?
No, but these are all Muslims that we're talking about now. Yeah, there are Arabs that are not Muslims.
What religion are they?
I don't know. But the issue is with Islam, it's not the Arabs.
Right.
Israel's issue is with Islam, not the Arabs. Any other questions or comments about what we covered? All right, let's talk about the Ezekiel 38 war. Look at Ezekiel 38, the first six verses there. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face against Gog, of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Prophesy against him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen fully armed, and a great horde of the large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. Persia, Cush, and Put will be with them, all with shields and helmets. Also Gomer with all its troops, and Beth Togarmah with from the far north, and with all of its troops, the many nations with you. All right, Now, please look at the map that's listed, that's labeled traditional Ezekiel 38 interpretation. The traditional interpretation is that Magog is Russia and Gomer is Eastern Europe. You can see Magog and Gomer listed there on the northern portion of the map. Do you see that? That is the traditional interpretation. We're going to talk more about that, but I'm going to present an alternative interpretation. The question is, who is Gog and where is Magog? Look at Ezekiel 38, verse 2. It says, Son of man, he's talking about Ezekiel. Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. Now, most translations in my Bible software, 14 of the translations that I have, translate those phrases there, the chief prince or the prince of Meshach and Tubal. Only three translations, the NASB, the New King James, and Young's Literal Translation translate it, prince of Rosh. Now, the debate centers on the meaning of the Hebrew word Rosh in Ezekiel 38, 2 and elsewhere. Well, traditionally, Rosh is believed to be an early form of the name Russia, which represents the Scythians. Now, many commentators and teachers follow what's called the Scythian Trail. They adhere to that perspective. That is, that Russia will lead the invasion, or lead an invasion, against Israel. That's the traditional interpretation. Now, other languages have words that are similar to Rosh, and that's sometimes used to justify translating Rosh as Russia. In other words, they think that Rosh is an early form of the name that eventually became Russia. But, you know, we are interested in the Bible's meaning of the word, and the book of Ezekiel was written in Hebrew, not current-day European languages, okay? In the Hebrew language, the definition of the word Rosh, I gave you there on your worksheet. The first definition primarily means the literal head of one's body. It also means the head or leader of a group. Or it can mean the beginning of something, such as Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year, or literally the head of the year. That's literally what Rosh Hashanah means. Or Rosh can also mean the top of something, like the top of a hill. So the Hebrew phrase is best translated the head prince, or top prince, or chief prince, not prince of Rosh. That's how it's translated in most modern translations. So, what is Gog's identity? Who is this person? Well, during Ezekiel's day, Gog, G-O-G, was the name given to the king of Lydia. And the Lydian kingdom comprised central and western portions of modern-day Turkey. Ezekiel 38, Gog is of Magog, and he's the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, all of which are located in modern Turkey. Magog, Meshach, and Tubal. So, there are two options for the meaning of Magog. One option is it refers to the Scythians. Now, by the way, the Scythians existed for about 600 years around the time of Christ. I think they came into existence or formed as a tribe around 500 BC, and they were influential in that area, the geographical area, until about 100 AD. They were a nomadic tribe. Well, let me finish this. Their interpretation of Magog referring to the Scythians is based on some statements by Josephus and other ancient historians of that time. The Scythians existed during Josephus' time, okay? So when he wrote about the Scythians, he was talking about people he knew about. They existed at the same time he did. In fact, Scythia was kind of a vague, derogatory term, all right? It referred to any number of barbaric northern tribes. So to call someone a Scythian was the same thing as calling them a barbarian. They didn't call themselves, to them, Scythian was the name of their tribe or their peoples, but to the cultures around them, that became a kind of a derogatory term. The Scythians were a nomadic people, so they didn't stay in one geographical area. They drifted around. So the most likely areas where they settled off and on at various times probably was areas of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and possibly some regions of southern Russia, southern portion of Russia. So that's why a lot of scholars and teachers today apply this term of Magog to southern Russia. But to identify Magog as Scythians is really a major stretch. And it's reinforced by that unfortunate translation, the Prince of Rosh, which appropriately is translated Chief Prince. The second option for Magog, which I believe is much more credible, is that Magog refers to Asia Minor and the Lydian kingdom, Turkey. There are very solid reasons for this interpretation. They're really too detailed for our study here because we're focusing on the wars themselves, okay? But this is based, what I'm presenting to you here is based on works by Joel Richardson, who's done very convincing research. I've read his works on this in particular, and it's very convincing. So look at the map of the alternate Ezekiel 38 interpretation. And you see where, Gomer and Magog, where they are now located in the area of Turkey. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. Instead of being north of there in Eastern Europe and Southern Russia. There is historical data that puts those two names in the area of Turkey. I think that this interpretation here makes complete sense without stretching scriptures, and it remains true to the Hebrew text. So again, Gog, the person, is of Magog, which is located in Turkey. And he is the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, which are regions of modern Turkey. So probably Gog will be the head or ruler of Turkey. Any questions or comments on that? Okay, let's move on. I want you to notice that the Ezekiel 38 list of nations and peoples, as I mentioned before, does not include those listed in Psalm 83. Palestinians, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Assyria, which is probably northern Syria or Iraq. So, the question then becomes, when will the Ezekiel 38-39 invasion happen? Well, Joel chapter 2 seems to describe the Magog invasion. It doesn't use that terminology, but when you look at it, there's some real strong parallels between Joel 2 and Ezekiel 38 and 39. Joel 2 verse 3 says the invasion strips the land. Ezekiel 38 and 39 says the objective is plunder and loot. Joel 2 verse 20 refers to a northern army. Ezekiel 38 and 39 say the army is from the far north. So the question then becomes, what is the far north? Well, a lot of people today will look at the globe or a map and say, well, due north of Israel, far north is Russia. Well, that's the way it is today, yes. But I think we need to look at this from Ezekiel's perspective. We're not talking about modern-day perspectives. We're talking about what Ezekiel saw and thought. The closest border of Turkey is 350 miles north of Jerusalem. In Ezekiel's day, people traveled by walking or by riding animals. 350 miles was a long way. So Turkey would qualify as far north. Besides that, there were no nations or even established cities in what is now Eastern Europe and Southern Russia in Ezekiel's day. The people who lived in that area were nomads. They didn't build cities. Okay, they drifted around. So really, I think that the perspective of Turkey being the far north is right on. I really do.
They did roads in after Rome came.
That's right. That was one of the big things that Rome accomplished, because they did that for their own armies and also for their own commerce. They built roads that a lot of them are still in effect today. You can still see them. We don't drive on them, of course, but these were roads they built 2,000 years ago. Joel 1, verse 6, says that not all nations of the earth will be involved in this invasion. Ezekiel 38, verse 2, 5, and 6, say only specific nations will be involved. So they agree there. So let's consider Joel 2, verses 28 to 31. You're going to recognize these things. After this invasion, he's described what the invasion is like. He says it refers to an army from the north and so forth. And he says, and afterward, I will pour out my spirit on all people. That should sound familiar. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your old men will dream dreams. Your young men will see visions. Even all my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my spirit in those days. I will show wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood. That should sound familiar. before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. What happens before the day of the Lord? Cosmic disturbance. Signs in the heavens and on earth, blood and fire and billows of smoke, sun will turn darkness, the moon to blood, blah, blah, blah. All that kind of stuff. But he's talking about this sequence right here. It's exactly what he's talking about. He also says that this war is going to occur before God will pour out his Spirit on all people. We said in a previous session that the gospel will be spread throughout the world by the end of the great distress or great tribulation. In other words, before the cosmic disturbance. So the sequence here is exactly right on. After the war, the Ezekiel 38-39 war, God will pour out his Spirit on all people, and after that, cosmic disturbance before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. The sequence is the same. Well, if this interpretation is correct, the Ezekiel 38-39 invasion occurs before God pours out his Spirit on all people and before the cosmic disturbance. Ezekiel 38-39 happens here, somewhere in this area. Certainly before the great distress starts, and that starts with the abomination set up in the temple, right? So the Ezekiel 38-39 happens before the abomination is set up in the temple. Any questions or comments on this so far?
When does the sealing of the 144,000 Jews happen? That's after the abomination?
I don't recall. I can see it on the chart, but I don't know at this point. Yeah, right. I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm just focusing on the wars right now.
Okay.
And I can see it on the chart, but I can't see where it is in the context. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. Any questions about what we're covering here? I'm not going to speculate. I think that there are indications of the caliphate in Revelation, but that's not a topic for tonight. Again, we could spend a lot of time talking about Islam in the context of end times. A lot of time.
I'm just making a comment that's probably more of a judicial interpretation. Mm-hmm. Give your response to it. When I see Joel 2:28, I think more along the lines of interpretation of how God poured out his Spirit on all peoples in Acts 2.
Yes.
And made it available. That's more of the traditional, interpretation I see in Joel chapter 2 there.
There's a key to prophetic language that it usually often has dual application, dual interpretation. Peter stood up and said, this is that which is spoken of by the prophet, I think it was Isaiah, wasn't it? Joel and Isaiah both said very similar things. He quoted Joel, didn't he? Okay. He said, this is that the one, this is what's spoken by the prophet Joel. However, as we've seen other places, like where Luke said that certain things had to happen first, but Matthew said they had to happen later, and come to find out they both were right. Okay, because there was dual fulfillment. And we see dual fulfillment frequently in Bible prophecy. So I think that the day of Pentecost was the first initial fulfillment of Joel 2, but the ultimate fulfillment will be right here. The day of the Lord. Because he says, before the great and terrible day of the Lord. There's only one day of the Lord. Well, the Bible uses the phrase day of the Lord for other major cataclysmic events, like in national invasions and that kind of thing. But the day of the Lord is this one right here. The others are kind of foreshadowing of the big one. Any other questions about Psalm 83 or Ezekiel 38 wars? I don't have all the answers, and if you were to pursue some of these things, start asking me a lot of in-depth questions, I'll probably get to the point of saying, I don't know. And some of what I'm presenting here is speculation. This is my perspective at this point. I reserve the right to change my perspective with time, but this is how I see it. Based on Joel Richardson's work and many others, Marvin Rosen, what's his name? Rosenthal, thank you, Marvin Rosenthal, others, bringing these things together, so I'm learning things, bits and pieces here and there, and putting them together and say, okay, this is how it looks to me. Well, let's see, I haven't done the conclusions yet, have I? Just kind of a review of what we've said so far. Let me give you the conclusions there. The nations listed in Psalm 83 invasion include those that are the greatest current threat to Israel, including those that sponsor terrorism against Israel. regardless of the location of Magog and Gomer, in other words, versus the traditional versus the alternate interpretation, it's very clear that the nations listed in Psalm 83 are not included in Ezekiel 38 Magog invasion. Therefore, it seems that Psalm 83 seems to be to describe a war in which the neighboring Muslim nations invade Israel but are totally defeated, unable to engage in the Ezekiel 38 Magog invasion. Here's a very significant point. We mentioned it a while ago, for example. If the alternate interpretation is correct, then all of the nations listed in Psalm 83 and Ezekiel 38 are all Muslim nations. That's kind of an eye-opener to me. In other words, after the Muslim nations listed in Psalm 83 invade Israel and are totally defeated, those are the immediate neighbors to Israel, then the more distant Muslim nations in the region invade Israel and also are defeated. Any questions or comments about Ezekiel 38? All right, I said I see three major Middle East wars. All right, the third major battle in the end times in Israel is what's called the Battle of Armageddon. Look at Revelation 16, starting with verse 14. They are spirits of demons performing miraculous signs, and they go out to the kings of the whole world to gather them for battle on the great day of God Almighty. Behold, I come like a thief. Blessed is he who stays awake and keeps his clothes with him, so that he may not go naked and be shamefully exposed. Then they gather the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. Verse 14 there, we see that what's called the Satanic Trinity gathers the world's kings for battle on the day of the Lord. The armies were beginning to assemble, and I believe they were beginning to assemble because they were about to attack Israel. The first Muslim invasion failed, the second Muslim invasion failed, so this is going to be a worldwide invasion. All the nations of the earth will participate in this battle here. Okay? That's their intent. I believe it is to destroy Israel because they remain intransigent. They refuse to go along with the world's demands. Go figure. And the world says, okay, that's it. You know, you've been a warring nation, you know, and you destroy these nations around you. You know, we're going to put an end to you. I believe that is the motivation for them gathering. That's what in verse 14, the Satanic Trinity gathers the kings and their armies. Who is behind all of that? The devil. Yeah, Satan. That's the way it's been from the beginning. Why? Well, because God calls the Jews his chosen people, and God calls the land of Israel his land. In fact, he, in the Old Testament, told the Israelites not to sell the land because it was his. Okay? And he took them into captivity for 70 years because they failed to honor his land with the Sabbath rests. Right? God gave it to the Jews, but he still claims it as his land. So whenever the world's armies come to take over God's land, you can expect he's going to respond. And that's exactly what we see right here. The world's armies are gathering. Satan is trying to destroy the Jews and recapture God's land that he calls his own. So he is sending out his minions, his leadership, to motivate the kings of the world to bring their armies against Israel. That is what prompts the Lord's return. Now, we're not talking about the rapture here. He came before this and removed us from the earth, poured out his wrath, and then after that, the nations of the world are going to say, now is our chance to totally subdue Israel, to get rid of this perpetual problem. So the entire world is going to marshal its armies against Israel, and Jesus said, that's it. That's the last straw. And he returns. I believe he returns prompted by this imminent destruction of his chosen land and his chosen people. Because notice there in verse 15, behold, I come like a thief. Who is that speaking and what does it mean? Jesus is speaking. That's that phrase, behold, I come like a thief. You see that phrase throughout the Gospels. Jesus is talking about that. He uses that phrase when he's describing his return to set up his kingdom. On his schedule, yes. And he's going to come like a thief, and he describes that. He says, if a person knew when a thief was going to come, they would be ready for it. He said, but I'm going to come like a thief. In other words, you're going to be totally caught off guard. You're not going to have a clue. But about. When you think, when you do this right here, wham, I'm coming back. I come like a thief. It's fascinating right here. Three verses. Verse 14 says, the armies of the world are gathering. Verse 15 says, Jesus says, I'm coming like a thief. And then verse 16, the armies are gathered at Armageddon. Now, there is a large plain in northern Israel near Megiddo that many consider to be Armageddon. Notice the armies gather there. That's an ideal staging area. It's a flat plain. I mean, you could bring hundreds of thousands of people into this plain. It is huge and flat. And it's just due north of Jerusalem. A few miles, but it's a perfect staging area for a large army or armies. The so-called Battle of Armageddon, by the way, that term, Battle of Armageddon, is not a biblical term. You will not find it in Scripture. Armageddon is the staging area. That's where the armies come together to prepare for the battle, which is in Jerusalem. The battle actually occurs in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, according to Joel 3, verses 2 and 3 and 14 to 16. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is now known as the Kidron Valley. That's the valley east of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives. It's a very significant valley. It's a huge valley. The battle actually occurs there, on the outskirts of Jerusalem. So, Jesus returns to prevent the destruction of Jerusalem. He will descend to the Mount of Olives, right? Revelation 19, verses 19 to 21 says, Jesus destroys the invading army. He has the being we refer to as the beast and the false prophet thrown into the lake of fire. The war is over. Any questions or comments about Armageddon? The so-called Battle of Armageddon is really the Battle of Jerusalem. It is the battle for Jerusalem, yes. It is the final battle for Jerusalem, and Jesus returns and says, it's not going to happen. And the description of the so-called plague that afflicts the invading armies is rather graphic. Basically, skin tissue dissolves while the guys are standing there looking. Any questions about any of these three wars? The Psalm 83 war, Ezekiel 38 war, or the battle, alleged battle of Armageddon? Which really is the battle for Jerusalem. Any questions about any of those? Okay. Let's bring it a little closer to home now. Those battles are very prominent in the end times. They play very significant roles in end time events. But they all happen over there, right? What about America?
And we'll see these.
We will be at the battle for Jerusalem. We're returning with Jesus. He will step on the Mount of Olives. We will be with him. It says that he will be accompanied by the armies, plural, of heaven. Angelic armies and armies of the saints. The angels will come back to enforce his will, and we will come back to rule and reign with him. All right, let's talk about war against America, question mark. How likely is a foreign army to invade American soil in today's environment? An army. I'm not talking about a missile attack. I'm talking about an army.
People on land.
It's not going to happen, right? Yeah, it's very unlikely. It's not even a concern because we are geographically large. Our military resources are spread out, which is a strategic advantage for us. A land invasion would have to come across Canada or Mexico. And we could see it from miles away. And we would intercept them before they got to our borders.
But to a degree, there is an invasion of sorts taking place now.
Well, I'm talking about land army. Okay? Stay on target here. Stay on target. So, is a foreign army, land army, likely to invade America?
No.
How about a naval invasion? That would require a massive armada. You could see it coming over the horizon, for that matter. And our satellites will see it when they leave port on the other side. What about a naval invasion? It would have to be a massive armada. And they'd be setting ducks out there. Yeah, they'd have defenses. But we would have the advantage, for sure. I would say that land invasion and naval invasion, really out of the question. What kinds of attacks might we experience in America? What about a traditional nuclear attack by ICBMs? ICBM is an intercontinental ballistic missile, okay? Something that can be launched on the opposite side of the world and takes it 30 minutes or less to get over America with a nuclear warhead on it. Actually, MIRVs are the armament now, multiple independent retargeting vehicles. So in other words, a single ICBM can bring, I think in the neighborhood of as many as 20 different nuclear warheads that can be individually targeted, sent to individual locations. In other words, one missile launch could cover an entire region with multiple nuclear blasts. Do you think that kind of thing is likely?
Yes.
We're building defenses for it, aren't we? In fact, I worked on a project that would do that. Yeah. I worked on a defense project that would built for that very purpose, was to intercept ICBMs, incoming missiles.
Once it gets out into space, then it can lay down on top of us.
Yeah, but we're also, but just about all the nations that are involved in that kind of warfare are also building defenses, developing defenses that would intercept while it's still in space, before it even re-entered the atmosphere. In fact, that was the system that I worked on 40 years ago.
Are we building offensive things like that?
Yes, we do have offensive weapons like that. Yeah. Yep, that was called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. You won't launch against us because we can hit you back just as hard. In other words, if you hit us, we're both going down. So you don't dare hit us. So yes, we have that kind of... A lot of them, yeah. Reagan and many others. Mm-hmm. So, I am.
You know, we're talking about nuclear explosions. You could 50 nuclear bombs could fall in the United States. Okay. The United States is out of existence. Where's the radiation from that?
Exactly. That's another reason that's not going to happen.
I mean, the enemy may do it, but then they're going to work with the cells, because they're going to get fallout eventually.
Well, not only that, as soon as we detect their missiles being launched, we're going to launch back, and our missiles will cross in space. So it's going to happen many places around the world simultaneously. So we're talking about the possibility of nuclear attacks. I think not very likely for a lot of the reasons we've talked about here, especially the immediate retaliation from the attacked nation, us in this case, which would pretty well sterilize the entire hemisphere, if not the entire globe, with radiation. I think that's a very unlikely response. I think it's a very unlikely occurrence, although we have to be prepared for it to make sure it's not going to happen. Another possibility is what's called an EMP attack. This is also a nuclear attack, except it's very different. An EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse, is what EMP means, electromagnetic pulse. This takes a nuclear weapon, probably a specialized nuclear weapon, and it's launched up in the above the atmosphere over a nation. And it explodes, and all the radiation stays out in space, whatever radiation is given off. The destructive part of this blast is the electromagnetic pulse that it sends out. Because this is an electromagnetic event and a tremendous nuclear explosion, and it sends out a spike of electromagnetic energy that literally will destroy electronics and electrical devices on the surface. If one of those devices were exploded, let's say 200 miles up, 200 miles in space, up over the state of Indiana, that could take out the electric grid from Colorado to the East Coast, from Canada to the Gulf. It would take out the eastern half or two-thirds of the United States. It's very real. Well, yes, we do. In fact, we were testing them back in the 60s. We were testing these things in the 50s and 60s. That's right. Any electrical or electronic device that's not militarily hardened will be fried by this.
But the old cars will start,
huh? Yes, because they don't have... if you can keep them running, yeah. The availability of the old... Listen, the issue is not whether I have an automobile that will continue to run. The issue is the fact that the electric grid is down. I can't even pump gas. You can't communicate. There's no communication. There's no electricity. Stop and think about it. No electricity. No. You're not going to be able to find it because 10,000 other people are going to be after it too. And you drive your car around when everybody else is looking for gas, you are a target. We're talking about electromagnetic pulse taking down the entire electric grid. It's a very real possibility. And it's not something that... No, it's not. And it's not just a matter of, okay, it's wiped out, we'll repair it. No, that's not possible. Because all of these transformers and electrical control devices and so forth that run our grid, our electric grid, are custom made. They are not off-the-shelf items. If you need one, you have to order it and wait for it to be manufactured and shipped to you, which takes months. So you see, if this kind of thing is horrific, because it's estimated that if this happened over America in the first 6 months, tens of millions of people would die because of the effects of the lack of electricity. Our entire system, our entire culture is supported by electricity. And in the absence of electricity, we're knocked back into the 1800s with none of the 1800s technology. You follow me? We are utterly dependent on electricity. So this is a major threat, and we recognize that.
I mean, if the electronic, if all that's gone, we can't control shooting one off.
Well, I said militarily hardened. Military sites are hardened against EMPs, against electromagnetic pulse, so that if we are hit by an EMP, we still have the ability to launch or to operate our military within a certain range. Obviously, any digital devices, such as communication devices and that type of thing, or control devices, probably would not work because they would be fried unless they were in the hardened area when the blast occurred. So, with that happy thought in mind, the result would be millions of deaths in just the first few months. Lack of refrigeration, food will spoil. How many people do you know who have implants, electrical implants? Those things will be fried by an EMP. They'll stop working just like that. By the way, a few years ago, Iran was making test launches of ICBMs from a cargo ship, just like the cargo ships that deliver goods to the U.S. We spotted them on satellite. We have intelligence data that shows us what they were doing. They were launching ICBMs that were designed to be launched from cargo ship containers. In fact, I saw an article just recently that showed those very cargo containers that look just exactly like the ones that are on these cargo ships you see on the ocean. They look just exactly like them. They're designed to look like them. Had four missiles, four launchers in each container. Those launchers could be brought right up to our shores and launched just offshore. They could be launched from a U.S. port. They would happen so fast, we would not have a chance to respond. We couldn't shoot them down because it would take a matter of a few minutes and they've hit their targets. They certainly could. Well, I've seen documented evidence of this, and I've seen articles online from reliable sources, actual photographs and so forth. I know these things exist. So is an EMP attack possible? Oh, yeah. Are small nuclear attacks, possibly even small EMP attacks possible from cargo ships or whatever? Oh, yeah. What about terrorist attacks? Are terrorist attacks likely? Yeah, they're happening now, right? Attacks on crowds or infrastructure? Almost certain, because those are considered soft targets. Chemical and biological attacks, probably not quite as effective because they have limited, they disperse quickly, so they have limited effect. Here's one that's a serious concern. Suitcase dirty bombs. Small nuclear devices that are small enough to be carried in a suitcase-sized container. By the way, when the Soviet Union collapsed, many of their suitcase dirty bombs disappeared. Nobody seems to know what happened to them. They are certain that they are on the black market and available to terrorist groups who have the money to buy them. Very conceivable that a suicide bomber could walk down the street in New York City and set one off. And that would make the city uninhabitable for decades. Maybe a year, maybe 100 years or more, depending on the half-life of the explosion. A dirty bomb is a bomb that creates a lot of fallout, okay, a lot of dirty radioactive fallout material. That's why it's called a dirty bomb. So are terrorist attacks likely? Yeah. Here's one that's even more likely. Cyber warfare. Hey, we're experiencing that now. In fact, there are several countries developing systems to take down other systems with cyber warfare. I'm aware of two nations right now that are training people to be cyber warriors, training them how to take down the enemy's systems, to attack electric grid, to take down businesses. In fact, we've already had cases where businesses in the United States have been shut down because of cyber attacks. The records were destroyed. They could tie up our banking system, our financial system, ATMs, and all this kind of stuff. They can hack into these systems and polarize them. They're working on these things. Heads up. This is real. Well, we have to learn enough about those things to defend ourselves from them, but also the mutually assured destruction philosophy still comes into play. Look, you do this to us, we can take you down too. Listen, anything a human designs, another human can hack. Well, here's the important point. We could talk much, much longer on these things. I really don't want to. This is not happy material by any means. The important point is this. Here's the good part. Jesus said we should not be alarmed or frightened by such things. Matthew 24:6, Mark 13:7, and Luke 21:9. Jesus said, do not be alarmed when you see these things happening. So, I have some questions for you. How can we avoid being frightened about attacks on America? Talk to me. No, seriously. Huh?
Cut off the news.
No. I'm not talking about not being aware of what's going on.
There's a focus on what's coming.
Yeah.
This is all coming to a head for a reason, right? And we know what the final book says, right? So how can we avoid being frightened about attacks on America? I'm not talking about being ignorant of what's going on. No, we need to be aware of what's going on. But how can we not be afraid or terrorized by these possibilities?
We're going. If we die, if we're killed.
But even if we have to live through these horrific experiences, how can we not be terrorized by them?
What God's going to do through it.
What
God's doing through it.
What God's going to do through it. You see, God tells us that everything he does for us is for our good and the good of his kingdom. Well, he tells us that everything he does for us is for our benefit and for the benefit of his kingdom. So, he wins. Not only that, but even if we are subjected to some of the most horrific experiences that we've talked about here tonight, do you think he'll give us the grace to go through them? If we have to go through and experience these things and they're worst, will he give us the grace to do so? What is grace? It's not a good feeling, okay? Grace is enablement. It's an empowerment. God's grace enables us to do whatever we need to do. God's grace empowers us to stand in the midst of the worst. So how do we avoid becoming terrified by all these possibilities we talked about and others? I may not feel the same way when I'm looking down the barrel or seeing something approaching. You know, I'm human. And that's going to be the, you know, kind of response. But that's why we need to prepare ourselves now, spiritually and psychologically. Psychologically acknowledge that these things are possibilities. And psychologically realize that whatever happens, God's in control. Now, when we say God's in control, that doesn't mean that nobody can win against him, that nobody's going to do anything bad to us. That's not what it means. It means that even when they do bad things to us, God uses that for our benefit.
I try to come to the realization that I could have been born at any other time.
Yes.
But I'm born, I'm here now.
For a reason.
I could have been born in any other nation.
Yes.
Under any other circumstances.
Yes.
I could have been born a female or whatever.
You should be so blessed, right?
somebody look after them.
Yeah. Well, no. Moving right along here. Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
But anyway, trying to come to the realization that if I'm here now, where I am now, with the knowledge that I have now, so now, Lord, what do you expect of me?
Right.
What's expected of me?
We could honestly say that God has honored us by putting us on this earth, in this place, at this time. Because He intends to do fantastically unimaginable things through His people. That's us. We can only talk about possibilities right now of the great things God is going to do, but they're becoming real. We're beginning to see them, and it's going to escalate. Yes, Satan's going to respond to it, but so what? We read the last chapter in the book, and God wins. And I'm on His side. I'm not trying to scare you. I just want to make you aware of how dangerous the world is becoming. Increasingly severe. Now, in a previous session, we talked about the role of difficult experiences, and we talked about how refining is extremely important. And God uses our difficult experiences to refine us, to purify us and strengthen us, to prove the value that we have, the strengths and abilities. He gives us opportunities to use the giftings He's given us. He's made you with the gifts that you have for a reason. And they're not for your personal consumption. But God loves you and does only what is best for you and for His kingdom. Why do you think God would leave us on earth while all these things happen?
There's still others that need to know Him.
There are others who need to know about Him, right? They need to hear the good news. People generally are not receptive to the gospel when things are good. But when things get out of control, that is out of their control, then they start getting desperate and looking for help. That's when they become receptive. They need people who know what's what. They need people who know that God is real and that He loves humanity and that He's made provision for us not to face eternal separation from Him. They need to know that. So we need to be prepared spiritually so that we have the spiritual strength and ability to do what God has called us to do, even under the worst of circumstances, and prepare ourselves psychologically, saying, you know what? If it happens, it happens. It doesn't matter. God is in control. God will work me through it. God will take me through it. God will remove me from it if He chooses. Whatever God chooses to do, it's okay with me. I say, yes, Lord. You know what the word Lord means, don't you? He's the boss. Don't call Him Lord if you're not going to do what He says. I'm serious. In fact, that's what Jesus said. Why do you call me Lord but don't do what I say? So we need to be preparing ourselves now. I believe that's why God has put so much emphasis in recent years on spiritual maturity and spiritual authority. He's preparing us for what's ahead. He knows what's coming, and He's setting us up so that we will not have to fall, so that we will not have to fail. He's preparing us for what's ahead so that we can be effective in His kingdom when everything around us is crashing. Though 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, it will not come near you. Psalm 91. You follow me? This is not about us. This is not about you or me. This is about God and His kingdom and the battle between His kingdom and Satan's kingdom. That's what it's all about. And God wins. There's no way Satan can win against God. There's no way. He's deceived himself to think that there's a possibility that he can do it. But he's a liar. He's deceived himself. So, God will leave us on this earth, even in the worst of circumstances, because we get stronger spiritually by resisting spiritual pressure and spiritual attacks. We develop spiritually. We become stronger spiritually. We also learn more about our relationship with God, about how we depend on Him, even for our existence, much less being effective in what He's called us to do. We learn those things through difficult circumstances. And the more difficult the circumstances, the deeper the lessons we learn. I can vouch for that. I've been through experiences I wouldn't wish on anybody, but I wouldn't take anything for what I learned in those experiences. They were invaluable lessons. They changed who I am. We can learn important spiritual principles by facing problems. You don't know how the kingdom works until you have to work within it. You say, okay, Lord, what do I do here? And He says, do this. And you say, okay, yeah, with Your help, I can do that. Evil assaults, listen, evil assaults against us prepare us for our eternal destiny, which is reigning with Christ over everything. That's our ultimate destiny. And the evil, the stuff we experience in this life, is preparing us for that. Everything he allows to come to us is for our benefit as well as the benefit of his kingdom. Just a few closing comments here. I see the likelihood of three major Middle East wars in the future. The Psalm 83 war and the Ezekiel 38 invasion both occur before the day of the Lord. Armageddon involves nations worldwide during the day of the Lord and follows the Lord's return to earth. We are already experiencing cyber warfare, and we should expect it to increase potentially to produce potentially catastrophic results. But God is in control, and everything will happen exactly as he said, whether we interpret Scripture correctly or not. That's the beauty of all this. I can try as hard as I can to understand what he's saying is going to happen, but whether I understand it or not really doesn't matter. But it's not going to determine whether he does it. Okay? That's what I'm trying to say. Whether I understand it doesn't determine whether he's going to be able to do it. So, I'd like for you to read that last statement on your worksheet with me in unison. You're going to see this type of statement as a continuing theme through this entire series here. Read it with me, please. No fear. I choose to let the peace of Christ rule in my heart. One more time, please. No fear. I choose to let the peace of Christ rule in my heart. Lord bless you. Thank you. I look forward to seeing you then.